This isn't about a cartoon. It's about a sound that wouldn't stop. Indiana, 1903, and the legend of the boy they called Goof. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're jumping straight into, well, a really dense piece of American folklore today. It's a story where this specific, quite unsettling sound, a high crack sound, a laugh that reportedly just wouldn't cease, allegedly became, you know, one of the most recognizable sounds in popular culture for a century. And just to be clear up front, we are treating this material strictly as folklore, as legend. We're relying entirely on the way the sources frame it. Reports say, the story goes, families claimed.
Exactly. Our deep dive today is all about unpacking what's called the stolen Goofy legend. We're drawing on accounts that span about three decades. They start with these institutional origins back in the early 1900s, and they run right through to a certain character's commercial debut in the 1930s.
Right. And crucially, this isn't just some, you know, isolated ghost story we dug up.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually cross-referencing it. We're looking at it against this really fascinating index of other folklore narratives. We call it the Inspector Story Index internally. And these other stories touch on remarkably similar themes.
Mm-hmm. Themes like institutional erasure, for instance, the alleged theft of, well, intellectual property, and this really unnerving idea of artifacts or maybe even recordings outliving the actual people who created them or were the source of them.
So our mission today really is to analyze the gravity of this specific legend. We're asking, how does folklore like this even emerge from, well, profound institutional trauma? How does grief, you know, look for a container, maybe find a screen? And how can an echo, literally an echo, hit you a ride on film and end up coming home through speakers all over the world?
It's a very dark narrative, fundamentally about transformation, about turning pain into a product.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really get the origin of this legend, we have to kind of build the room, understand the environment where the trauma is said to have begun. The setting is absolutely critical. It establishes this context of, well, profound isolation, systemic failure, really. We're talking about the Indiana State Children's Home around 1903.
And the sources really emphasize this wasn't just like a regular orphanage wing or anything. This home reportedly kept a specific separate ward. It was designated for what the era, pretty cruelly termed, incurable cases. That label itself, incurable, it immediately signals a place where perhaps active care has sort of given way to just containment.
Precisely. And the imagery that the accounts associate with this ward is deliberately stark. You get descriptions of bare wooden floors, the atmosphere at night dominated by silence mostly, but broken only by something that traveled farther, lingered longer than footsteps. The noise itself, the sound in this legend, it became the defining feature, the inescapable characteristic of the whole place.
So who's making this sound? Who's at the center of this, this auditory legend?
The central figure is a young boy. The folklore says he suffered from this severe, persistent affliction. The sources, keeping it non-graphic, describe him as having jaws that never closed. And this led to a state of, well, perpetual agonizing laughter. But the legend is very explicit. This wasn't a sound of joy, not at all.
Right.
He laughed, reportedly, until his lips split, until his throat bled. It was a physical symptom that became the source of intense auditory trauma. For him, obviously, but also for anyone who had to hear it.
Wow. That's such a deeply visceral image of suffering, involuntary suffering. And what's particularly chilling, and maybe a classic example of that institutional dehumanization you mentioned, is how the staff reacted.
Yes, the reaction. The sources confirm the institutional response was, well, practical, in a cold way, to minimize paperwork. The nurses, according to these accounts, they gave him this nickname, a single syllable, Goof, allegedly because his actual name, his proper name, felt too heavy on paperwork.
Goof, just like that.
Just like that. And this institutional shorthand, it's crucial to the legend. It's presented as this immediate erasure, turning a child who had a history, an identity, into just a convenient label, a label describing his condition. The system, the story implies, discarded the human and just kept the tag.
And that tag, Goof, and that specific sound, they're the only things that really lasted, aren't they? The legend is clear. The noise was just inescapable.
Absolutely. The persistence of the noise is what seems to elevate this from just a private tragedy into something more like enduring folklore. Visitors, staff, they apparently wrote about it. That the laugh described as high, strained, broken, it ran down the corridor like cold air. It wasn't contained by walls. It was an echo, a constant presence you could hear at night down the halls.
So it essentially became the auditory signature of the place.
Yeah.
Of that systemic abandonment. It testified to the institution's failure, maybe to cure or even comfort him.
Mm-hmm.
It became the most memorable thing about his time there. The sound itself is the witness carrying the weight of the place.
And that auditory weight is critical, because the accounts suggest the sound was so unique, so particularly fractured, that once you heard it, you supposedly couldn't forget it. Which, of course, sets the stage perfectly for the later part of the legend, the claim that the sound wasn't just replicated and actually recognized.
Okay, so the narrative takes its first really sharp turn here. The boy, known only by this institutional nickname, Goof, he dies very young, 13 years old. The physical presence is gone. But, you know, in any normal institution, the record should still be there, his file. But this is where the legend introduces this crucial pivot about institutional memory, right?
Yes, this is the moment of what the legend frames as definitive systemic erasure. The story goes, quite simply, that the file vanished. All the formal documentation, his life story, diagnosis, any treatment records, or lack thereof, his death certificate supposedly deleted. Wiped from the institutional record, the paper trail is just gone.
But what's really fascinating here, and it speaks right to how folklore often preserves things, is the contrast. The contrast between the vanished file and the physical, material proof that allegedly did remain. So the system, according to the story, successfully removed the administrative trace, the accountability.
But not the photographs. The visual documentation apparently survived. In the legend, these photos, these physical objects, they become the primary artifact of his existence, the undeniable proof. And these weren't, you know, formal portraits. They were visual evidence detailing his condition.
And the sources give these specific, quite haunting details about what was in those photos. They describe his long, kind of lanky body, and maybe most hauntingly, these alleged modifications the nurses made. Bandages that had been cut and sewn, fixed to his head to look like ears. They're described as sagging bandage ears. That's such a specific, unforgettable visual.
It really is. And this persistence of the artifact, the photo, when the record is deleted, that's a powerful recurring theme we see across that folklore index we mentioned. If we connect this to that broader concept of institutional erasure, it gives it more context.
Okay, let's bring in the index again. The sources mentioned the inspector story themes. How does the vanished file here connect to those other legends, like Real Wendy?
Right, so take the Real Wendy legend that's indexed as involving an asylum file about a child who supposedly never ages in the records. The insight there is that records can freeze time, right? They stop documenting change even while real lives keep moving forward. But here in our Goofy legend, the record doesn't just freeze, it vaporizes. The institution tries to delete the history entirely.
Which almost feels like, well, it feels like an admission, doesn't it? And the logic of the legend, the absence of the file becomes its own kind of evidence.
Precisely. And we see that mirrored in another index legend, Klaus Richter, the erased soldier. That story really emphasizes that erasure becomes the evidence. The deliberate lack of paperwork proves the severity of the institutional attempt to control the story. They could get rid of the file, remove that administrative paper trail, but they couldn't allegedly control the image that remained, the boy's modified look, those very distinctive visual artifacts.
So the visual trauma is preserved, the body, the grin, the bandage years, while the paper identity is systematically destroyed. This setup is just perfect, narratively speaking, for the next stage of the legend. How that trauma supposedly jumps from a forgotten file cabinet in Indiana to the burgeoning world of popular media.
And now we navigate this significant gap in time. About two decades pass. Between the boy's death, reportedly around 1903, and the time frame of the alleged, let's call it intellectual property theft, late 1920s, early 1930s, this period is critical. It's the era of rapid expansion in animation and the huge shift from silent film to sound-on-film technology.
So we're moving from that bleak, isolated ward in Indiana to, well, the highly commercialized, fast-paced studios in California. It's a jarring contrast. And the legend insists that during this time, those surviving, haunting photographs, they somehow found their way into the hands of the media industry. What do the sources actually suggest about how that happened, that chain of custody?
Well, the folklore maintains this element of secrecy, calculated secrecy. The sources describe a secret reference session, a closed-door meeting, where reports say high-level artists were shown those surviving photos, photos of the deceased boy, for reference.
Wait, hang on. So the legend asks us to believe that this visual record of suffering from a specific ward in Indiana was somehow just available, transferable, to artists in a completely different industry, hundreds of miles away. What does the story suggest about why? Why these photos?
The accounts imply it was the distinctiveness. The boy's appearance, the lanky frame, that wide, fixed expression from his condition, and the really strange, specific shape of those bandages. It was deemed unique. a ready-made caricature almost. In studio language, a compelling design. The sources suggest the photos might have been sourced through, you know, unofficial channels, backdoor channels, maybe a former employee of the home. The secrecy is key because it frames the whole thing as theft, not inspiration or consultation.
Okay. And the mechanical transformation starts right there. This is where pencils, allegedly, turn proof into posture. The sources claim that the dead child's unique physical look became just geometry, traced and replicated, frame by frame, onto animation cells. The trauma itself structurally absorbed into the visual identity of a character meant to be funny.
That transformation is profound, if true, taking visual evidence of uncontrollable physical symptoms and just abstracting it into a repeatable, marketable cartoon design. The visual pain becomes a standard shape. But as you hinted, the theft, according to this legend, wasn't only visual.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting, perhaps the most disturbing part. The focus shifts very decisively to the auditory theft. In the sound department.
Yeah, we have to place this in its technological context again. This was the pioneering age of synchronized sound, very early days. Recording used wax discs primarily, sometimes acetate or shellac, and physical needles cutting grooves. The act of recording sound was a physical analog process, literally carving the sound wave into the wax.
And the legend claims the sound department got very specific, highly unusual instructions about the voice for this new character.
Yes, they were allegedly tasked with achieving a specific pitch, a specific quality, a fractured tone that, the legend says, only some people had ever heard in real life. The instructions were supposedly to mimic or maybe even reproduce the boy's specific high broken laugh. And because this was analog recording, the resulting sound quality depended entirely on the needle's precision, the wax quality, the acoustics.
But the truly disturbing detail within the folklore is how they allegedly achieved that specific cracked quality, that permanent break in the sound.
The sources describe the pursuit of that pitch with chilling precision. The instructions were, apparently, to mimic the sound, including the break, by pressing wax needles deeper each time he screamed. Essentially, to chase that specific crack in the air by physically altering the recording process. The legend uses that visceral image, the needle cutting deeper, to symbolize this physical effort. An effort to replicate and eternalize a sound born of, while agonizing, involuntary pain.
That technical detail really strengthens the core premise of the folklore, doesn't it? If this were digital sound today, mimicry is one thing. But back then, analog 1920s, to get a sound so specific it could be recognized as identical later on. The claim that they were trying to capture an existing traumatic pitch rather than just inventing a funny voice becomes much more central to the legend's power. It implies they weren't trying to match a voice actor. They were trying to match a trauma.
Exactly. The synthesis here, in the legend, suggests this comprehensive two-pronged approach, exploiting trauma for IP. The visual pain allegedly became standardized geometry for the animation, and the unique auditory pain became pitch-matching instructions for the sound recording. The legend holds that they transformed documented human suffering into a repeatable, marketable entertainment mechanism, piece by piece.
So we have the alleged theft of the visual blueprint, then this very specific, calculated replication or maybe capture of the sound's unique, agonizing quality.
And after 2 decades in this sort of limbo, existing only as a photograph, maybe an institutional memory, the mechanism of alleged theft culminates in 1932. That's the year, 1932. The year the cheerful, familiar character makes its debut on screen.
Implied pause, 1932. And the contrast is just almost unbearable, isn't it? This light, cheerful arrival of a new funny character in this blossoming world of animation and sound, a character with that wide, fixed grin and that instantly recognizable familiar giggle or laugh. The sources explicitly state the character's long, lanky posture matches the specific posture seen in those remaining photos of the boy, the ones with the bandaged ears.
Visually, you know, maybe you could dismiss the connection. Coincidence, creative influence, maybe. But the real connection point, the absolute heart of the legend, is the auditory recognition. This is where the folklore shifts from being about, say, studio gossip to becoming about social trauma, lived trauma.
Because the sources claim that families who had known the ward, maybe worked there or had their own kids there, they stepped forward immediately. As soon as they heard the character's voice on screen, they recognized it.
And this is where the precision of the folklore is so crucial. The claim isn't just that the sound was similar to the one they remembered echoing down that corridor. The families allegedly recognized the sound. They claimed it was the same. Now, this is a hedged claim presented strictly within the folklore passed down, but that insistence on sameness suggests the pitch, the fractured quality, was so distinct, so fixed, that it could only have been, in their view, a literal recording or an exact involuntary replication of the original trauma, not just acting.
I find that really compelling. Auditory memory, especially linked to trauma, it's notoriously sticky, isn't it? The fact that the sound is described as high, cracked, and unchanging across a century, that's what gives this legend its staying power. It allows those families or their descendants decades later to argue this sound is permanently static. It's a recording looping endlessly in commercial media, not an evolving vocal performance.
And this recognition, this chilling identification of the sound's supposed origin, leads right to the legend's powerful conclusion, the thesis line, really, the moral judgment on the whole story. It wasn't created, it was taken. Every rerun repeats a last breath.
Wow. So what does this all mean for us listening now? The persistence of that unique, fractured sound. Within the legend, it's interpreted as the persistence of the trauma itself. It's the proof, the story claims, that the sound was captured, archived, and then just endlessly reproduced for profit.
Yeah, this legend functions as an incredibly powerful piece of, well, cultural reflection. It really illustrates how deep, maybe unresolved grief, institutional trauma, it seeks a container. And in the 20th century, mass media, the screen, often became that container. It shows how a deeply unsettling memory, an auditory one, an echo, how it can literally hitch a ride on film technology and come back home to the public through every speaker, every theater.
And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, that thematic index we keep mentioning, this cheerful character, allegedly built from suffering, becomes the ultimate artifact, doesn't it? An artifact that systematically outlives its original tragic source.
Yeah.
And outlives the institution that fostered that tragedy in the first place.
Absolutely. That theme, the artifact surviving the creator, it's highly visible in our indexed folklore. Think about the legend referencing Buzz Lightyear, the idea that artifacts outlive their makers. But here, the artifact isn't some DIY gadget or invention. It is the sound, the specific, allegedly recorded sound itself. The boy died at 13, the file vanished, but the laugh, packaged for entertainment, it achieves this dark kind of corporate immortality.
And we have to come back to that contrast, don't we? Between the hallway in 1903 and the studio in 1932, the sources force us to look at what institutions keep silence. Maybe sanitized records and what they lose. The boy's name, his file, accountability. The photos remained, yes, forcing the memory into a visual container. But the sound potentially found a container that was infinitely more accessible, infinitely more repeatable, the media landscape.
And legends, especially ones dealing with erasure, with stolen identity, they tend to sharpen right where official records, institutional or corporate, try to blur things or sanitize the past. They provide a kind of moral framework when the official story tries to hide extraction behind the language of creation.
This legend really illustrates a deeply troubling mechanism, doesn't it? How corporate systems can, perhaps silently, absorb documented trauma, whether it's a photo or a specific sound recording, and make it a permanent, accepted, even beloved part of the commercial narrative, all without credit. Or maybe without consequence.
It's the institutional failure, potentially compounded by corporate absorption. You know, consider the Monopoly legend, the claim that the game teaches debt, obedience. The sources here suggest that, just like Monopoly supposedly trains you before it pays you, this form of entertainment might train the audience. Train us to accept a history framed as creative invention, not traumatic extraction. It normalizes the consumption of suffering, perhaps.
And the power of the legend really lies in the permanence of that alleged sound. It forces us to visualize that haunting closing image the folklore suggests, the looping film strip, where the last frame is always a breath, symbolizing the endless involuntary repetition of a traumatic moment. Transformed, monetized, put into commercial media, that high, cracked sound becomes perpetual, involuntary stasis.
The sound itself becomes the ghost in the machine, just running on repeat, forever detached, supposedly, from its painful origin.
So this deep dive took us through really four key reveals wrapped up in this folklore. First, the persistence of the boy's unique, fractured laugh back in the institutional home, 1903. Second, that calculated erasure of his file, contrasted with the haunting survival of the photographs. Third, the alleged secret reference session, where suffering was supposedly translated into marketable geometry and pitch-matching instructions. And finally, that family claim in 1932, that the sound wasn't just similar, but identical, the same sound they remembered.
And the nature of that specific sound described consistently as high, cracked, unchanging it, suggests a moment captured precisely because of its abnormality, its pain. We really have to consider the immense difference ethically between an institution failing to cure something, which is passive failure, neglect maybe, and a corporation allegedly choosing to eternalize that specific traumatic moment. In perpetuity, for commercial gain, it turns the memory of a tragedy into a reproducible loop that effectively can't be switched off.
It certainly raises some profound questions, doesn't it, about where the popular stories and sounds that surround us actually come from, and what hidden historical echoes they might still be carrying across generations. It suggests we might be listening to a recording we never even intended to hear.
Indeed. It forces us to listen differently, perhaps, even in the most common repetitive sounds in our culture.
They called it a laugh. The legend calls it a recording. Either way, never learned how to stop.